Hello, thanks so much for tuning in and joining us on the Zonal Marking Podcast brought to you by The Athletic. I am Ali Maxwell, and with me this week, Michael Cox and Tom Warville of The Athletic. Hi, Michael, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Are you okay as well?
Yeah, you didn't seem sure there. Definitively, I am very well, thank you for asking. Tom Warville, how do we find you on the road to recovery from that unfortunate injury just a few weeks ago? But back in sound mind and sound on the podcast and on The Athletic site as well. How's things going?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks, Ali. I realised actually the injury was quite similar to that of Andre Gomez, but I don't think I'm going to be looking quite like him come the end of my recovery.
Out of interest, you bring up Andre Gomez, and my first thought was the reaction of Son, who had inadvertently hurt Gomez or injured Gomez. Led us into your memory from that night, if you don't mind. What was the reaction of the bloke on the other end of the injury?
It was mixed. He did help me by putting his jacket under my head when I was obviously lying on the ground in pain, but then also 10 minutes later was like, sorry mate, I've got to go, can I have my jacket back? Which was quite an awkward moment of me writhing around in pain, him slowly removing his jacket from under my head. But no, it's I don't have many positive memories from that night, but that's one of them.
Let's get into to today's pod. Just after, I remind the listeners that if you'd like to be a subscriber of The Athletic, where you can read all of the writings of Tom Warville and of Michael Cox and so many of their colleagues, then you can join for just £1 a month if you head to theathletic.com/zonal marking. That's so much good stuff on site at the moment, and that offer really is something. So do make the most of it. It's also where you can listen to these podcasts ad-free if you would like. So theathletic.com/zonal marking is the place to be. Coxie, your usual intro to the topic, please. This is a follow-up to last week's first episode, which was about surviving after promotion to the Premier League. Now we're looking at essentially the topic of second season syndrome.
Yeah, exactly. How to stay there after you've survived your first season. We've got two this time around. One is Aston Villa, who have made a very good start, and the other is Sheffield United, who have made a not very good start. But yeah, we're going to be looking again at the stats and just the general decision making at clubs. You know, how do you push on? How do you make sure you don't drop off and go back down again?
There's evidence to suggest, I haven't got all the stats to hand, but if you can get through your second season, you are likely to establish yourself to the extent of, say, a five-year stay in the Premier League. So, you know, if staying up is one thing, staying up again is very, very important and can really change the fortunes of your club for the better in the long term. Tom, Michael mentioned our two examples for this season anyway, Aston Villa and Sheffield United. They had mixed fortunes in staying up. Sheffield United about as comfortable as it gets, and Aston Villa almost the opposite of that, but doing just about enough. How are they getting on this time round?
Yeah, again, it's funny. It's kind of roles reversal at this stage. Aston Villa obviously have had a flying start, beat Liverpool in probably that now famous 7-2 victory. And so they seem to have tightened things up at both ends. I mean, we spoke last time about their kind of change of fortunes pre and post lockdown. But we've actually seen Villa, you know, create better quality chances going forward and conceding lower quality chances at the back. So it seems that decent transfer window, the buying of Emiliano Martinez in goal, and just, you know, more time with the coaches, more time kind of making the team better has definitely helped Villa. From a numbers perspective, they look like they could be in for a decent season. Sheffield United, on the other hand, their kind of XG going forwards is slightly down, and that's down to having more shots, but of lower quality. United created some of the kind of highest quality chances on average last season. I think their XG per shot was in kind of the top three in the league. And at the moment, they're kind of in the middle of a finishing slump. I mean, at the time of recording, they've got 7 XG and 3 goals. So it says something around there, them being unable to convert the chances they've had. But it does seem that, you know, their biggest problem last season was having enough shots. They've now increased that number, but they've dropped the quality. So from an attacking point of view, not amazing. And then defensively as well, their numbers are around the same as last season, I think around 1.4 XG a game against, which is mid to lower end of the Premier League table. But the biggest difference last year was Dean Henderson, you know, prevented around 7 goals based on the quality of shots on target he faced. And Aaron Ramsdale is not having that level of impact in goals. So I'm hopeful that United work it out, because they've been a really fun and unique side to watch. There's a ton more games left for them to do so.
Michael, July the 17th, of 2020, Why Sheffield United Are the Best Promoted Team of Modern Times, written by yourself. And I very much enjoyed reading the piece and your case for Sheffield United being the best promoted team of modern times. But also, just deep down, I enjoyed it because, you know, with all due respect, sometimes you come across like not a lot excites you. You're like the sort of beaten old detective. The job's just got a bit too much for him. But actually, Sheffield United are a side that caused you genuine delight last season. What do you make of how they're taking on the league for the second time?
I mean, I thought you read my piece last week about Ajax and Atalanta. That was a very passionate piece from the heart. Yeah, I mean, Sheffield United were great. I mean, I don't like to use the word jinx in you know, journalism terms, because ultimately what I write about Sheffield United has no bearing upon how they will do. But I mean, I really waited until I was sure they were really good. I waited 36 games to say, look, they're the best promoted side that we've seen. They lost their last two games of last season, and they obviously haven't made a very good start this time around. So yeah, that was an interesting piece to write. And it compared Sheffield United with how the best promoted sides are done. In the end, they finished 3 points short of Wolves, who were the best one in recent times. Ipswich Town, the best promoted side that we have seen in the Premier League, as we mentioned last week, on 66 points. But yeah, they're also relevant to this one in terms of dropping off dramatically in the second season.
Michael, Ipswich, 2000-2001, under George Burley, Marcus Stewart scoring 20 goals, 20 wins in 38 Premier League games. They qualified for the UEFA Cup, where they took on and beat, albeit only in one leg, Inter Milan. How did they get on in the league in their second season?
Very, very badly. They went down. A bizarre campaign where they barely won before December until they got eliminated from the UEFA Cup. Then they kind of went on a pretty good run and seemed to have got themselves out of danger, and then collapsed again in the last third of the campaign and eventually went down. Yeah, that was an interesting one. I researched Ipswich for that Sheffield United piece, and spoke to Nick Ames, who works for The Guardian and is a very big Ipswich fan, and was just talking to him about why they did so well and why they dropped off. And Nick was quite interesting. He said basically, and I think this is comparable to Sheffield United, he said in that first season, there was a lot of players in the Ipswich side who had something to prove, who'd been written off early in their campaigns, who weren't just kind of wily veterans who'd been in the Premier League 10 years and didn't really care whether or not they stayed up or how well they did. And they really performed above expectations. And he said that what they probably did wrong for the second season was they got in a lot of players who probably didn't quite fit into the dressing room. So quite big names. I mean, Sereni in goal replaced Richard Wright. Finidi George, who, of course, people know from that great Ajax side. Sixto Peralta up front. Marcus Bent, who was a bit of a Premier League journeyman even at that stage, I suppose. And that probably, you know, altered the mentality in the dressing room. They probably didn't have the togetherness and the cohesion, which I do think is very important if you're an underdog trying to punch above your weight.
And the complete reverse of Ipswich Town, the golden boys, in fact, for what we're talking about today, at Leicester City, who, of course, just about stayed up in their first season following promotion, and then only went and won the Premier League in their second season. What an insane thing that still is to say out loud, Michael. I don't really know what analysis there is here, but Leicester won the Premier League in their second season at the level, having been promoted.
Yeah, which remains, you know, the most remarkable thing I've seen in football. I mean, even if you say, let's say that they didn't win the league, let's just say they finished sixth or seventh, we'd still be talking about them as this is the best improvement we've seen season on season in recent terms from a side in their second season. And while there were a lot of particularly individual factors, I think we have to go back to the fact that they made a very ruthless decision to part company with Nigel Pearson, who had done a very good job to steer them out of danger, and they wanted to push on. They got in Claudio Ranieri, who was a manager who was accustomed to working with bigger sides. He'd been at Chelsea, he'd been at Valencia, he'd been at Juventus, he'd been at Roma. This was a manager who was used to steering teams into the, well, European places at worst. So yeah, it goes back to what we said last week in a slightly different situation. Sometimes there are circumstances where I think you need to be honest, you need to part company with your manager, and you need to say, look, if we're going to make the step forward, we don't want this guy who's been very good at getting us out of the championship and you know, just about keeping us up. We want someone who knows how to work with top players, who knows how you motivate teams to finish in the top half of the league. So, yeah, I don't think anyone at Leicester expected they would win the league when they appointed Ranieri, but they did expect, or they did hope, that this was a manager who would take them to a higher level.
Well, they were correct, Tom, weren't they? Kante in midfield, Vardy up front, but it's Ranieri on the touchline that really made the difference. With this group of players and that man in charge, they managed to catch lightning in a bottle, really.
Yeah, definitely. I just think Ranieri's game management was so good, and Leicester's game plan was just so solid, such that they would, you know, go a goal up and they'd just be able to hold leads really well. I think that for me was some of the best football to watch in recent years. Just the Vardy kind of counter-attacks, just how efficient the midfield was and getting the ball forward. And I mean, it's probably the best we'll ever see of Danny Drinkwater. But also, you know, Leicester are a club that obviously came up one season, survived, and then they've won the league. But then since then, they've actually gone from strength to strength, and they've done really well to actually, I think in the long run, they're probably batting pretty well when it comes to the transfer market and actually making more hits than they are misses. There's a couple of players such as Adrian Silva and Islam Samani who were kind of bigger investments after that title-winning season that potentially weren't too good. But then there's been some kind of, you know, shrewd other signings. I think Youri Tielemans wasn't obviously the cheapest, but I think that his stock dropped so much at Monaco, such that they actually got a player who, you know, his value is far outweighs the price they paid for him. So yeah, Leicester are a case study on obviously if you're going to come up and stay up, maybe not all teams can win the league first before making themselves Premier League mainstays. But yeah, they've definitely done a lot of things the right way.
Classic data analytics guy using baseball terminology and football discussion there. Batting well in the transfer market, more hits than misses. Coxie, talk to me through a few recent examples of teams that stayed up and then kicked on and then established themselves, the sort of teams that we see now week in, week out in the Premier League and consider, you know, as I've said there, established sides at this level.
Well, I would say that Burnley are the most interesting example. I mean, people probably forget how good their second season up was. They finished seventh. They got into the Europa League, which was an extraordinary achievement, really. I think the interesting thing with them is it was their, you know, that was their first and then second seasons up in that stint. But they'd previously had a Premier League experience where they came up in 2014-15 and they were very, very cautious in terms of, well, on the pitch, but also in terms of the transfer market and spending. They didn't really add to their squad. They played pretty defensively throughout the Premier League. They only scored 28 goals. They actually had quite a good defensive record, only conceded 53 that season, which for a newly promoted side is very good. But they were kind of taking a long-term plan of, look, we'll take the money from going up, we'll get the parachute payments when we go down, and we hopefully will be able to build for a longer stay in the second stint. And I think Dyche was aware of that. I think that was always the long-term plan. And, you know, it probably was difficult for Burnley fans that season. They finished 19th. And, you know, I had a nagging sensation that had they just been a little bit braver, maybe got in a couple of exciting wingers, for example, they maybe could have pushed on. But they didn't want to take that risk. They wanted to play it cautious. They wanted to be steady. And now, I mean, I know they had a bit of a wobble in 2018-19, which was probably partly due to the fact they were playing in Europa League and forced to juggle those demands. But I mean, the start of every campaign, I see people tipping Burnley to go down. And I just think, as long as Dyche is there, I just can't see it. You know, it's such a solid formation. They defend really well. They cause teams problems with their method of attacking, which is a little bit rudimentary, but maybe goes back to what we've said with the likes of Wolves and Leeds and Sheffield United, in that it is quite unique. It's not the challenge that teams are facing every other weekend. And so, yeah, I just really admire how they've done it. You know, Burnley is, I guess, historically a big club if you go back to the kind of 50s and 60s. But in recent years, I mean, they were down in the fourth tier for quite a long period in the 1980s. And yeah, I now think of them as one of the more established Premier League teams and one of the teams who's probably most likely to survive of the teams who probably finish in the bottom half, if that isn't too much of a backhanded compliment.
Tom, I know you've also got some thoughts on Burnley and how they've established themselves.
Yeah, I think that Burnley, and we spoke on the last podcast about kind of the impact that Bielsa's had on this Leeds squad. And I think that, and to echo Cox, kind of Dyche and this Burnley squad, I don't think that you get the same level of performance if it isn't for him being there. And again, I do think, looking at the squad, I mean, the squad is quite old, and I think that after Crystal Palace, they are the one kind of bigger, you know, question marks longer term about the, you know, if there's another manager that comes in, they've got a big rebuild to do potentially to get, you know, a squad that they want. So I think that Palace have got to get their next manager appointment right after Roy Hodgson, but I think that Dyche is arguably an even even bigger one just because of the current makeup of the squad. I imagine that they'll be absolutely fine again this season, and actually they've kind of under the radar brought in a couple of younger players. I mean, obviously Dwight McNeil has been nearly an ever present for Burnley since he made his debut a couple of seasons ago. Josh Brownhill has played every minute so far this season, and Jimmy Dunn as well is kind of coming off the bench and contributing, and is a centre back, I'm pretty sure. So, you know, they've got decent younger strength and depth there. It's just further up the field that they kind of either need investment or to find kind of younger talent from the academy. But I mean, Burnley are always a different team to watch. It's just, I think, longer term there's a bit of a cloud over them, let's say.
Among the other sides, Michael, you've got Wolves, who are well established now, even after only a few seasons as a top half Premier League side with a number of star players and a fantastic manager. And then there were two sides that came up together automatically from the Championship in Newcastle and Brighton. These two still with us. Three seasons completed. Brighton 15th, 17th, 15th. Newcastle 10th, 13th, 13th. To what extent can both or either or neither of those teams be described as established Premier League teams now, having got over the tough first two seasons?
I would say that they are still starting the season thinking about avoiding relegation. I think in part that's because, you know, as we've mentioned before, the sides who have come up in the past couple of years have been pretty strong. I think they're in different situations. Brighton came up, you know, their first time in the Premier League. They took quite a bold, big decision to replace Houghton with Graham Potter and wanted to move things in a different direction. Newcastle also changed their manager, but of course that was Benitez leaving, and they went for Steve Bruce, who I'd say is the opposite to Potter in the sense that he was more of a considered a safe pair of hands, someone who had been at this level before. So yeah, they're in quite different situations. I would say of the two, I probably fancy Newcastle to survive more, actually. I know people might be surprised at that just because, you know, there's a lot of instability about the club, particularly with the ownership. But I think actually they've got a good squad. They've got a manager who knows how to drill a defence, I would say. And I just fancy them to maintain their relative upward trajectory over the past couple of years. Brighton, I still have some question marks about. I mean, I think Potter's a very good manager. I think you can see that from his achievements elsewhere. But sometimes I watch them, I just think they don't convert their promise into kind of end product enough. And there's a lot of games I think they should win that they don't win. And a lot of games where they look good against the big sides, but then in the kind of relegation deciders, they're struggling a little bit more. So, yeah, I fancy Brighton to survive, but they're never quite as comfortable as I would like them to be.
I am interested to know if Tom Warville is in agreement with you there, which is generally the case, but I'm thinking maybe not in this scenario. Tom, everything I know about you is that you like to put a lot of importance on long-term strategic thinking in terms of the football operations side of a club. And we have two sides, from my opinion anyway, from my viewpoint, on opposite ends of the spectrum here. And Brighton, for whom everything they do is fairly strategic. That comes from Tony Bloom, the owner, and a whole host of other personnel working on the football side of things, but outside of the training ground, outside of the dugout. And a Newcastle side who, I think it's fair to say under Mike Ashley, don't give off the image of being hugely strategic long-term thinkers. Where do you stand on that?
Yeah, it's kind of a head and heart thing, isn't it? Newcastle against Brighton. I mean, looking at expected goals so far this season, it's funny that from what Michael says, kind of the eye test is that Newcastle are kind of potentially the stronger and better side, and Brighton haven't quite taken their chances. I mean, if we look at the expected goal difference per game between these two teams, Brighton are actually fifth with 0.5 expected goals kind of per game for them. So essentially they're overall creating better quality chances than they are conceding. And Newcastle are 18th and they're conceding kind of half an XG more a game. So there's kind of a goal between them, those two sides at the moment. And obviously,
so which one's the head and which one's the heart?
I think the head is Brighton because they're definitely thinking through things and doing things in, you know, long-term strategic manner, etc. And they've kind of made a managerial hire that in Potter is someone who I think they outlined that he could take them to the next level. And I think Newcastle are, you know, this is a Steve Bruce side that in a game recently, they played four wingers, two of which were kind of in central midfield. And yeah, I just think the other thing to mention with Brighton as well is, and I think Ali, we kind of mentioned it off pod, is that just in the transfer market that you can't pigeonhole them. I think in certain circles, Brighton go down as some of the, you know, smarter recruiters, and they don't waste their money on older players and all this. But then this summer they've spent money in terms of wages, at least, on Adam Lallana and Danny Welbeck, two players who have Premier League but also injury history to contribute to their side. So yeah, I'm intrigued to see after a few more games where these two sit, because right now Brighton look quite solid and Newcastle not so.
I'm very keen for you not to share too much of what we talk about off pod, but I will allow it in that one period. Okay, let's look at some examples of clubs who achieved the first objective of staying up and then crashed. We've talked about Ipswich Town already. Michael, who joins them when we're talking about these sides that did the hard bit but couldn't follow through?
Yeah, I think going back about 15 years, I think this is maybe where people really started to kind of talk about the second season syndrome, because West Ham and Wigan came up the same year and finished top half and then dropped off a lot. They survived in their second year, but not particularly convincingly. I think Reading, actually a year after them, is probably one of the better examples. So they came up and they finished eighth. They could have actually finished a lot higher, and people were talking about them as, you know, having European ambitions at one point. They didn't really strengthen from one season to the next at all. They really stuck with the side that they had, and they dropped off dramatically 10 places and finished 18th and went back down. We've only seen them briefly return to the Premier League for one season in 2012-13. So yeah, I feel like it was maybe I mean, a lot of these things in football can come from a couple of examples and just become established in everyone's mind. And I'm not sure that second season syndrome, looking at recent years, is necessarily something to be particularly afraid of. There's been a couple of examples. I mean, Huddersfield came up, survived, finished 16th their first season, and then had a really dreadful second campaign. But I would tend to just say that they overachieved a lot in that first season. And when you look at their performance in the Championship the year they got promoted, it wasn't really a surprise that they eventually came back down. It was, if anything, just a surprise that they did last one season. I don't know why that was. Maybe just there was a good mentality and a good vibe, and just the excitement of being in the Premier League maybe helped them over the line in that first season. But yeah, just looking at the stats, I'm not particularly convinced that second season syndrome is something everyone has to be particularly worried by.
Carried along by pure vibes, that Huddersfield side, having been promoted with a negative goal difference, the first side ever to be promoted to the Premier League with a negative goal difference. Tom, who else have you got in this category?
Yeah, a couple for me are QPR in 12-13 and 14-15. The 12-13 side were the kind of 17th oldest, came up, were promptly kind of relegated again. And then when they were kind of re-promoted in 14-15, they got even older, which kind of goes against, again, you know, long-term thinking, how you plan for the future. But looking at kind of the composition of the squad, there's some great names in there. I mean, in 14-15, they brought in Rio Ferdinand, and they had him kind of anchoring the back line at times with Clint Hill. There was, you know, Richard Dunn in there as well for probably 6 own goals in the season. Nico Crunch was there, of course. And they actually brought some kind of interesting names. I mean, Stephen Corker came in, Leroy Fer, I think this was before he started bouncing around a couple of Premier League teams, Maurizio Isla on a kind of season-long loan, I think he was at Marseille at the time, and Eduardo Vargas. So they're actually, like, on paper, some interesting players. Again, it was just a matter of fitting all the pieces together into a coherent team, which, yeah, sadly wasn't possible.
Just the 4 wins for them in 38 games, I think it's fair to say they weren't particularly coherent, and it's certainly fair to say, what, 5 years on, that the decisions they made around that time have had a huge impact on the club in the mid to long term, and they're still kind of paying the price in many ways for what they did in that period. Michael, what about second season thrivers, teams that stayed up and kicked on?
Yeah, I'm going back a long way now. I'm going back right to the start of the Premier League era, but Blackburn were promoted in time for the first Premier League campaign. Actually, through the playoffs, they finished 6th in the old second division, as it was then. They finished 4th in their first campaign. Obviously, they were spending a lot of money at this point and getting some good players in. But they improved to finish 2nd in their second Premier League campaign, and then indeed in their third Premier League campaign, finished in first place. I think we all know that the inequalities in the Premier League and between the Premier League and the Championship have increased to the extent that you can't really do that anymore. But yeah, they're probably the best example of a side who, you know, they improved by 13 points from one season to the next and went from 4th to 2nd. So, yeah, they are the best example of a side who pushed on in their second season.
Sadly, Warville and I were both in nappies around that time. So I'm looking for something a little bit more modern from you, Tom.
Yeah, I mean, one side that I highlighted, they're not exactly, didn't have the kind of success of Blackburn. But I thought that when Swansea came up in 11-12, they kind of, you know, did pretty well. I think that they finished 11th in their first season and had kind of a core group of eight players that they relied so much on. They had a midfield anchored by Joe Allen and Leon Britton, which probably weren't going to win any headers, but they could definitely keep the ball moving around. And then they improved the next season to ninth, which is exactly the kind of movement that you want, you know, going further up the table. I don't think they had to re-uproot the squad completely. And obviously then Swansea were in the league for, I think, six seasons. So, yeah, I thought Swansea were an interesting one, especially in that first season when they came up. They were the second youngest team in their promotion season. So, yeah, it's not if you're good enough, not if you're old enough, you're good enough. Oh, I got that so wrong.
Well, okay. Michael, tactics-wise, is there anything interesting about this specific scenario of trying to kick on in your second season in the Premier League? I've got a phrase clanging around in my head, which is the phrase to be found out. And sometimes when there's a team that has maybe a slightly different style of play or just an uber specific style of play that brings success, there's always a concern that they will get found out. Does that often happen to teams in their second season in the Premier League?
Yeah, I haven't heard that said about Sheffield United yet, which I think is the obvious example to use. I mean, I think this is interesting because I think 20 years ago, this probably did apply. I think that if, you know, you face, let's say, Sunderland when they came up and they were playing, obviously, long balls to Niall Quinn and Kevin Phillips on the end of things, that's the kind of thing that maybe ahead of a second season, you could think, OK, the defenders have had two experiences of that the previous year. They know what to expect. But I mean, opposition scouting has improved and progressed so much over the last 10 years. I mean, you know, you can go on Y Scout or one of these systems and see exactly how Sheffield United are playing, you know, before they've even played a Premier League game. I mean, there was so much fuss about the overlapping centre-backs this time last year or last summer, I should say, that I can't really see why getting found out should only happen after a year now. I think if you're going to get found out, it probably happens within a matter of weeks. You know, I think it's just the situation has changed so much. So, yeah, I think we're going to have to keep an eye on Sheffield United and how they do this year. But I would say that's probably not a phrase that applies so much in the modern era. I just think things have changed from 10, 15 years ago.
The one thing I thought with Sheffield United in the summer is that they could really use a bit more dynamism in midfield. I mean, John Fleck is definitely a really willing and able runner, same as kind of Lundstrom, but they don't really have anyone in there who particularly carries the ball or takes on players in central areas that well and disrupts opposition shape. And I really did wonder if Wilder and Alan Neil would kind of recognise that and try and change that. But it definitely seems that they've just gone for kind of more of the same and to reload the squad in some areas where they might have been a bit light due to injuries, which is a shame. And I do wonder if we see anything like that come January, depending on where they sit in the league table.
I mean, recruitment, which you've touched on there, is a fascinating aspect of this discussion as well. Your first year in the Premier League, you have access to untold riches, around £100 million given to you as part of the television deal. Your second season, same again. You really are in good health financially, unless you've really done something wrong. And there's money to spend in the transfer market to evolve, should you wish to. Michael, we spoke about Reading earlier. I guess they're kind of an interesting case study here. You talked about that side, which had come up from the Championship with a records points tally, 106 points. Scarcely believable, really. And then did so well in their first season in the Premier League as well. But you talked about how they didn't do it a ton to the squad. They kept trying to ride that wave and they ran out of steam. There's got to be a balance to be found, doesn't there, between starting to evolve and starting to build a Premier League quality squad that's robust in the long term and also not moving away from what's got you success in the first place.
Yeah, I think there's a few interesting examples. I mean, in the last few years, I'd say the difference between Brighton and Burnley has been interesting. I don't really see any intention from Burnley to move away and play a more progressive style of football. I think they will just play the Dyche way for as long as he's there. And when he leaves, I imagine they'll probably go for someone roughly similar. Brighton have taken the opposite approach. They clearly believe they have, you know, the wider footballing infrastructure to move on and progress and establish themselves higher up the league and play a better style of football. And that's why they replaced Chris Hughton, who I think was a pretty safe pair of hands, and got in Graham Potter. I mean, I think it can be difficult. And I mentioned earlier that Brighton are never quite as convincing as I'd like them to be. And I'd say that sometimes it can be harder for certain types of player to play against teams that are parked behind the ball after you've built up possession for a long period. I mean, there's an example, Crystal Palace here, who for years, you know, not just under Roy Hodgson, but before that under Warnock and Allardyce, they were very good on the break. They've always had players who are very speedy. They're very direct. They like running into space. And it was only a 4 or 5 game period. And I'm not saying they played particularly sparkling football, but when they went Dutch and got in Frank de Boer, that was a complete attempt to try and play a different style of football. And they didn't really make the recruitment to get the players in. I think one of the few was Riederwald, who came in from Ajax. And I mean, a few years later is establishing himself as a central midfielder rather than a centre back, which has been unexpected. But I mean, that was just an example of if you're going to change your manager, you've probably got to change your players as well. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, Brighton, I think, are a really fascinating side just in terms of their progression under Graham Potter. I really go out of my way to try and watch the way that they play because I would like to see them progress. I'm just, not completely convinced just yet.
Tom, where do you stand on this? I guess, to an extent, what I'm asking is, if you're not making changes to the style of play, which has had success, or to the playing squad, which has had success, is there an extent to which just standing still can be moving backwards in the Premier League?
I actually think there's one element of that which we kind of miss out, and I don't think it's just as simple as a team kind of clicking a button and you know, submitting a bid and a player turns up the next day at the training ground for a medical. Like, I think they're, with promoted teams, especially those that are kind of in less developed, maybe not the right word, but essentially like non-built-up areas. I mean, if you're a team that's in, I think, you know, Burnley are a team that can actually struggle to get talent in because of just the area that they're in. And I think players from overseas, when they come to the Premier League, usually are kind of, you know, sold on the area being Manchester instead of Burnley, because I think it could be a bit of a turnoff. And I've heard similar stories as well from kind of Reading and Norwich, and players who are in talks with the clubs to go there, and they're kind of saying to the club, you know, if I move here, can I live in London? Because there's nothing to do in Norwich or Reading. So I think that there is an element of like good intention for clubs to restock and sign players and kind of, you know, build the squad once they're up to stay for the future. But I do, for certain clubs, that actually is quite a tough challenge.
Coxie, sometimes clubs decide to be fairly ruthless in terms of replacing managers that have got them to a certain level, that have got them into the Premier League and then survived in their first season. And as with the Hughton to Potter switch, Brighton's thinking being that Potter could help revolutionise evolve the playing style and develop younger players to a greater extent and essentially raise the ceiling of the football club. And as you've said, whether that ends up being the case is still, the jury's kind of still out. But which other teams have done it this way, and what do you think about that as an approach, trying to upgrade the manager, I suppose, as the club has upgraded its standing in the English game?
Yeah, I must say I was really struggling to pick out examples of sides who've done this really successfully. I think when clubs have changed their manager, it's often been to go for a kind of safe pair of hands and avoid relegation in terms of getting in someone like Hodgson or Allardyce or Tony Pulis. So yeah, I mean, I really think the Potter example will be, how he's obviously survived his first season, but if he can establish Brighton for 5 years, I think that'll be used for years to come in terms of this is what you've got to do to survive. And if they do have a difficult season this year or next year and it doesn't work out, then people will kind of use it as a, you know, be careful what you wish for, shouldn't have sat Chris Hughton. So yeah, of the sides who've been newly promoted, I do find them particularly fascinating, and certainly one for us to keep track of.
And why haven't I heard the name Maurizio Pochettino in that answer? Because that's an example of this, isn't it? Adkins to Poch, that felt a bit brutal at the time for Adkins, who had taken them so far, but they were appointing Pochettino.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's an interesting one because obviously it happened in midway through the first season, and at the time I thought it was actually really harsh on Adkins, who, as I think I mentioned last week, had, you know, learned his lessons from the opening weeks and really stabilised the side. So, yeah, I mean, that's an example of where I'm surprised they did it midway through that first season. I think had they had they waited until the end of the season and got Pochettino in, that almost would have made more sense, because I thought they were fairly on track for promotion and probably risked, you know, ripping up a plan that had started to work. But yeah, I mean, that's a good example of someone who, yeah, in the second and third season really did take them to a higher level. And then the manager they got in the year after that was Ronald Koeman, who obviously had won European leagues as a manager before. And that really felt like obviously a very different level.
Michael, I feel like Stoke City might be an interesting case study of sorts, a side that came up with a uber-specific style of play that helped them achieve early success in the Premier League and then kind of reached for something a bit more, brought in a lot of players with bigger names, you know, a higher caliber supposedly of player, but it didn't work for them in terms of success, and now they find themselves back in the second tier. That there really is no one way of going about things, is there?
No, there's not. So I mean, Stoke I think was a slightly interesting example, where obviously they came up under Pulis and they were very consistent under him. They finished I think 11th, 12th, 13th in all five seasons in the Premier League under him. And they then moved away from him and brought in Mark Hughes, which was quite a difficult ask for Hughes, I think. But they actually improved. They finished 9th, 9th, 9th in his three seasons. It went a little bit downhill from there. And obviously they ended up relegated after Hughes had left. But yeah, I thought that was two separate things, really. I think they probably made a very wise managerial decision to bring in Hughes, who did a good job, but then maybe got a bit carried away with the calibre of player and probably overloaded a little bit too much on very fancy continental names, maybe moved a little bit too far away from the ethos that had been built up under Pulis. So yeah, that's an example, I think, of a side who did push on, and I wouldn't necessarily attribute their relegation to moving away from Pulis and that style of play.
Difficult running a football club, isn't it, Tom? I mean, stick with the manager that got you there, or try and raise the ceiling of the club with a better manager, stick with the squad of players that have achieved success, or try and improve on them and potentially lose a little of the team chemistry. It's a very tough balance to find. What about Bournemouth? They came up to the Premier League and they wowed a lot of people with their style of play, and Eddie Howe got a lot of plaudits, and actually they kind of just sank slowly in the end. What do you put that down to? An issue with not being able to evolve in the way that we've discussed?
Yeah, I definitely think that a lack of evolution from Howe, and I think just a failure to fix problems as they arise, ultimately was the reason for their downfall. I mean, I think defensively their numbers were just not good from 17-18 onwards, and I think they were, you know, a bad run of games, or a, you know, a swing of variance away from being relegated. And I think in the end that's what's happened. There's an argument to suggest that Howe did really well with the squad that he had, but he wasn't overly helped by the dealings the club made in the transfer market. I think if you think back to kind of how they'd spent their Premier League money, I mean, Bournemouth always come up on these lists of just like, you know, teams that have spent money on players that have ultimately not worked out. You've got Dom Solanke, Jordan Ibe are two very, very obvious examples of players who've gone for 15 and 20 million each, I think, and not exactly lived up to their price tag at all. And I do think they're, you know, they were definitely leaning on players last season, which you could question whether they would make it into the Premier League starting 11 of other teams in the league. I think Dan Gosling has always been a pretty serviceable and useful player at this level, but when he's playing week in, week out, and at times was their main chance getter, I think that something's, you know, definitely up. So I don't know, ultimately maybe it was a good time for Howe to walk away at the end of the season to kind of refresh, because I do think he's a good manager and he did so well to bring the team through the leagues, let's not forget, from League One all the way up to the Premier League. But equally, I think that maybe it's healthy for managers to have time out of the game to learn new ideas and implement new things into, you know, their mindset, really, of how they're going to approach the next job.
I guess, as always, and kind of with the previous episode as well, there's so much of this that is just on a case-by-case basis. I've been trying to get you to make sweeping statements, but you've performed admirably to avoid doing so. And I think that's right, isn't it? Because everything's kind of contextual and every case is unique and specific to a club. And I kind of get the feeling that kind of what you just said there about Bournemouth, Tom, that really what you can say for sure is you need to understand your club's weaknesses. You need to understand where problems might arise in the future. Try and get ahead of them and be swift and sort of quite bold sometimes in your decision making, but ultimately to act on issues before they become too large, as potentially was the case with Bournemouth, as you mentioned. Guys, thank you so much for humouring me here with this little two-part series. First, about promotion to the Premier League and how to approach your first season, but also surviving in the second season as well. The difficult second album from Leicester winning the whole thing to Ipswich, who had a spectacular collapse, and so many teams in between. Thank you to Tom Warville and to Michael Cox for talking me through it. You can find their brilliant written content on the Athletic site and app, and you can sign up for £1 a month if you go to theathletic.com/zonal marking. That's also where you'll be able to hear this podcast and all the other Athletic podcasts ad free on the app on the Athletic site as well. So do join us again next week. Let us know what you thought about this podcast, any thoughts you have on surviving the tricky second season, but also we'd love to take some ideas from you guys for future episodes and other things that you'd like us to take a look at in the zonal marking way. Thanks so much to the guys for joining me. Thank you for listening. Make sure you're subscribed, and we'll talk again next week on the Zonal Marking podcast, brought to you by The Athletic.